December 23rd edition of the Anaheim Calling podcast. It's the Festivus edition. The Anaheim Ducks finishing up a long, winding six-game road trip here tonight against the Pittsburgh Penguins in Pittsburgh, John Gibson's hometown, or I guess close by to his hometown. I believe he's from Whitehall, Pennsylvania. The Ducks closing out the road trip in style, winning the game 4-0. John Gibson just getting a shutout in front of his hometown fans and family and friends, so that's nice to see. Joined tonight, as always, by Jake Rudolph. Jake, it's Festivus. How you feeling?
What's up, what's up? I'm doing great. Just sipping on some scotch out of my Christmas vacation moose glass. It's good time.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah, it's going to be a nice little reprieve here from the NHL season for a couple days. The Ducks don't play again until Wednesday at Honda Center against the Vegas Golden Knights, so that should be fun. So we're going to get a nice little break here. So I guess by the time you're listening to this or are about to listen to this, it'll be Christmas Eve / Christmas. So a Merry Christmas to all of our listeners. We sincerely appreciate you guys listening, and we've had a lot of fun on the pod so far. And if it's on Christmas Eve, well, Merry Christmas Eve, but a Merry Christmas nonetheless.
Yep, yep. Merry Christmas to all and to all a good night, even though we've got the rest of the pod to go.
Yes. All right. Well, with that out of the way, let's get into this game because this is a fun one for the Ducks. You know, going into tonight, the Ducks have had an interesting road trip where they've had some really, really low moments, but they've also had some things to maybe like a little bit more from an underlying standpoint. You know, in some of these games where they've lost or they've blown leads, they've still kind of looked okay at 5-on-5 if you look at some of the numbers. And tonight, I guess, was kind of the culmination of that, where not only did they look good at 5-on-5 to start the game, but they also got the goals, which was huge right off the bat. Andre Kasha makes good, or I guess not right off the bat, but in the first period, around the end of the period, Andre Kasha makes good on a Chris Letang turnover. Just a bizarre pass by Letang. Kind of had a weird game. Yeah. Kasha grabs the puck, streaks in all alone, just showing off that speed. His lethal forehand and backhand move. It's funny how it works almost every time. The few times he doesn't score on a shootout breakaways when he doesn't do that move. Yeah. And he gets Murray to bite on that move and just tucks it home on the back end.
Murray was beaten by Dre. But
is that your new thing? Is that the new thing you're going to be pushing now?
I've been trying to remember to say it anytime Kasha does something good, and I just always forget. So it's been in my head for a while. Don't you worry.
Okay, yeah, I've been noticing that you like to come up with these lines, and look, I'm on board with the beats by Dre or beaten by Dre. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, we're all about comedy here. It's all about having fun.
Yes, exactly. But moving on here in the first period, Rickard Rakell. Another nice play by the Ducks where just kind of controlling down low. Getzlaff picks up an assist here. His 9th point in 6 games on this road trip. So
good.
We're going to get more to Getzlaff later, but he's just been absolutely dominant.
Such and a beast.
In a multitude of ways. Rakell comes in all alone, I guess from the left wing on Matt Murray. Puts on a little move, forehand, backhand as a righty on the left side, and it just squeaks through, I believe, Murray's right arm. And, you know, kind of a soft goal by Matt Murray, but yeah. by the same token, I mean, Rakell, a former 30-goal scorer, left all alone in front. That's not you can't really blame Murray there, although it did look bad. And, you know, give Rakell credit. He put on a move to at least get Murray moving to open up the possibility of a mistake happening. So I'm not really ready to blame Matt Murray there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it looks worse in hindsight if you're looking at it just because it kind of barely squeaks through. I think the fact that he got a big chunk of it and still went in makes you kind of wonder if he could have had the entire save, but I think that's more of the kind of one where he got a piece of it with a really good attempt, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah.
And it was just a great move and great play by Rakell. Great job for him to kind of take the puck off the boards and get it there, and that's kind of the second... I mean, that's the second goal the Ducks had gotten off a turnover by the Pittsburgh D.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Andre Kasha, once again... getting on the board later in the period. I mean, it's just incredible. You know, Andre Kasha, it's really interesting because some people that we know are skeptical about Andre Kasha's game.
Benny!
And I'm kind of, and I look, I respect Benny's opinions because I think generally he is very inquisitive and he kind of tries to really kind of seek out the truth in most scenarios. But with Kasha, I have to disagree with the skepticism because it's almost like whichever line he plays on, that line does better at 5-on-5. He's skilled offensively. And yeah, like maybe he's not like this like all-star or anything like that, although I don't think anyone is necessarily saying that. I don't know. I just feel like he's great. Well, like the numbers kind of seem to bear it out.
Well, and I think that line worked well tonight, and I think it's going to probably work well moving forward if they want to stick with it, because Kasha, I mean, his nickname, I think, with the team is the Energizer Bunny, and he just
it's so fitting.
Yeah, and he just constantly goes, and he's great at puck retrieval. He's not a big guy, and you don't have to be good in the corners. And he just kind of gets there and is really good at lifting guys' sticks and kind of getting the puck out of there. And he's the puck retrieval guy on that line for Getzlaf and Raquel, and is able to kind of get it into good spots for them. And they were really, really, really good tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to get more into that later, because I feel like there's a little more here to break down. Sorry, so I actually said that Kasha scored another goal. Totally erroneous on my part. Third goal for Anaheim would come in the second period. A goal from Andrew Cogliano, who comes in on a breakaway, another breakaway for Anaheim. Just a brutal turnover by the Pittsburgh Penguins power play, which was actually getting booed by the hometown fans at the PP&G or whatever the hell their arena is called.
Paint Center.
Yeah, just a bizarre. Like, don't call your arena after a paint company, please.
Igloo used to be such a good name for their
Igloo's
old barn.
Igloo's perfect. Let's just call it the Igloo.
Can we go back to the pond also, please?
Yeah, although Ponda has a nice ring to it, but melding the corporate with the colloquial there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Andrew Cogliano with a nice little backhand, forehand move, just tucks the puck right between the wickets of Matt Murray. Another goal that doesn't look great on Murray's part, just because anytime a goalie gets beat 5-0, I mean, with all the advantages they have, the big pads and the butterfly style, it doesn't look great, but you really can't blame Murray. In my opinion, you really can't blame Murray once again, because it's a breakaway given up by the power play, which is interesting, by the way, because I believe Tyler Dello of The Athletic had written a piece a few weeks back now about the top power play units in the league. And he had noted how, I believe it was the Pittsburgh power play, and how dangerous it can be, but also how it kind of allows a lot going the other way. And I feel like tonight was an example of that, where Cogliano comes in, gets that goal, and it just never felt like the Penguins were really in control. So just a really nice display and a burst of speed by Cogliano.
Yeah, and if I'm remembering correctly, I believe that this now puts, or this has Cogliano 2 goals behind Paul Kariya for the most shorthanded goals in franchise history.
Really?
Yes. If you'll give me a minute, I will eventually find that.
Okay. Well, while you find that, I'm going to wrap up the recap here. Mm-hmm. So in the second period, the Anaheim Ducks make it 4-0 on a power play. Right as Brian Hayward was once again whining about the Ducks not getting any calls. I just have to bring it up. I actually, you know, I complain a lot about their complaining. So tonight I was proactive and I switched broadcast for the third period. And I really don't regret it, because Steve Mears does a great job with the Pittsburgh broadcast. I love that he got that job, because before, I mean, you talk about homerism with the Ducks broadcast, but the Pittsburgh broadcast used to just be on another planet in that regard. So anyway, all that aside, to end the second period, I believe it was like in the dying seconds, Rickard Rakell makes just a beautiful saucer pass across the crease to Cam Fowler. And what was really nice about that play was that Rickard Rakell lifted his left leg up just ever so slightly to kind of fake a shot. And you could tell it really drew in the Pittsburgh penalty killers. And he just then feathered it across to Fowler, who took the necessary time needed to set up his shot, fired it far side, and Tristan Jarry just couldn't get it across. Where he did get across, but it just wasn't fast enough. Fowler makes it 4-0, and at that point, you know, the Penguins do put on some pressure in the third period, but you could really feel the game just kind of slip away from the Penguins, who had been putting on, you know, a push in that second period, but it ended up just being too little too late for the Penguins. And the Ducks walk away with a 4-0 win. So,
yeah,
all around good effort.
Yeah, that goal to end the second period definitely kind of felt like the backbreaker there. So I do have the stats now. Paul Kariya has 16 shorthanded goals for the Ducks. Cogliano now has 14 in his career as a Duck. So he's sitting back. So that will be kind of cool if Cogliano eventually passes Kariya on that mark.
That's interesting. Yeah, I had no idea, but I guess it makes sense because Cogliano is so fast.
Yeah.
So let's get into this game now that we've kind of got all the facts in front of us. So one thing that really stood out to me tonight, and this isn't like, you know, breaking any news here, but Ryan Getzlaf looked particularly dominant. I put this out on Twitter, but I'll reread it here since I feel like it bears repeating on the pod. But if you look at Getzlaf's numbers in specific matchups, tonight against Crosby, a 53.8% Corsi, against Malkin, a 78.5 Corsi, against Kessel, 76, Letang, 66. I mean, obviously the Penguins are not a good possession team this year. They kind of never really are, but they're the Penguins. It doesn't really matter to them. But neither are the Ducks. The Ducks are not a great possession team either. And for Getzlaf and that line to just bowl over the Penguins' best players, that's something that has to be encouraging, I feel like, for the Ducks moving forward.
Yeah, definitely. And he's so good. And I don't know if you want to pivot to this, but we do have a Twitter question kind of about
that line. Yeah.
How would you rate the new look top line of Raquel, Getzlaf, and Kasha? Personally, I thought they were really, really amazing. And we briefly kind of talked about Kasha's ability to get into the corners and kind of retrieve the pucks for that line. And I mean, I think Getzlaf can make anyone look great, but I think those two with him really work well. And it kind of provides a bit of a different look with Getzlaf and provides a couple different options. And I think it's really kind of good moving forward. I really, really like that line.
Yeah, I mean, shout out to Datadog here in the Mixler chat saying, Hayward is making you the Hayward of the hashtag ACPod. Look, I gotta say, I believe, in the intermission between the second and third period, Kent French asked Brian Hayward, "Well, what makes this line so successful, or what makes Kasha so good next to Getzlaf?" And I actually fully agree with his point. What he said, like you just kind of said, is that, you know, Kasha is a great forechecker and he opens up space for everyone else. He gets those pucks and he allows Ryan Getzlaf to get to work in the offensive zone. And I agree wholeheartedly. And this is something that you and I have talked about before on the pod, where Kasha is just so relentless in his pursuit of the puck in all three zones. It's not just the offensive zone, because you see guys in the NHL. I remember DeLuise was really a glaring example of this. They only try for a puck in the offensive zone or in an instance where they know they have a chance of getting it. Kasha just doesn't care. He just goes after everyone, and he's so fast and he has so much stamina that he's able to recover, which is something you rarely see. And maybe that'll diminish with age, but who cares right now if you're Andrei Kasha? So yeah, I think that the reason why that line looks good so far, and obviously our sample size is far too small to really make a sweeping judgment, but by the same token, it just seems like it's a marriage that would work well. And I bring this up a lot, but if you rewind to last season, when Getzlaf's 5-on-5 game and as a line really took off was when Patrick Eaves came over. And Patrick Eaves is not exactly the same player as Andrei Kasha, but is similar in that he's a good forechecker and he's just kind of a buzzsaw below the goal line. And I think Kasha is exactly that. And you know, you factor in Ricard Raquel on that other side, on the right side, who's just so skilled and who can make a play out of a phone booth. And you have a pretty winning combination there. And tonight was no different.
Yeah, definitely. I do want to just kind of add briefly what their 5-on-5 shot metrics were tonight. And so
they were ridiculous.
It was insane. Getzlaf was 21 shots for, 9 against for 70% Corsi for. Raquel, 17 for, 7 against for 70.83. Kasha, 17 for, 5 against for 77.27. Scoring chances were Getzlaf 7-4, 5 against. Raquel 5-4, 3 against. Kasha 7-4, only 1 against. And all of them in high danger were at Getzlaf and Kasha were at 5-4 and none against. And
yeah, Raquel 0. Were, yeah. Goose egg.
Raquel was at 4-4 and none against. So it was just pure and utter dominance by that line. And I even was thinking kind of just midway through the game, like anytime Getzlaf was on the ice, something was happening. Something good was going to happen when he was on the ice. And it was so much fun to watch.
But what I found interesting, like to me, what makes those numbers more impressive though, and this is something that, you know, I think really is important to know, is that the Ducks are the away team in the situation. So they're not getting the last change. They're not getting the matchups that they want. And if you look at the opposition minutes against, Getzlaf's line was primarily against Getzel, Crosby, Letang. I mean, they were against the other team's best. So it's interesting that Sullivan would go best on best, although that may be something that he does, that maybe that's just a tactic that he goes with. I don't know. But so these numbers aren't just coming against,
no,
you know, the third and fourth lines of Pittsburgh, who are legitimately bad, by the way. So Yeah, I mean, that just makes it all the more impressive and all the more reason why I think, you know, I think spinning this forward, going back to the question about, you know, the top line, I feel like they have to kind of, they have to give this line a bit more time to gel and to really see what they can accomplish. Because to me, if that can allow you to put Corey Perry on a third line, yeah, let's say next to Adam Henrique and Kevin Waugh, then that gives you two legitimate offensive lines. And the Ducks haven't, I mean, I don't even know when the last time the Ducks had that was.
It was probably...
You'd have to go far back.
No, it was probably, it was 2 years ago.
Offensive lines?
Offensive. I mean, because two years ago they ran with Getzlaf, Perron, Stewart, Kessler, Cogliano, Silverberg, and they had Raquel, Perry, and I forgot who was the third person on that line.
Santorelli? Nah, he like never
played. No, but the issue the Ducks had in the playoffs that year was Raquel was hurt and coming back from that. And I think it was like something with his stomach or something along those lines. So
Jamie McGinn,
that's right. Jamie McGinn.
I think he was on the first line and Stewart was on the third line. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, those were three legit scoring lines, and that team was so dangerous and just kind of got hit with injuries at the wrong time.
Yeah, and they still made it to like a game seven of the Western Conference Finals.
So. No, that was the team that got knocked out in the first round in game seven.
Oh yeah, yes. Okay, it's all coming back to me now.
Yes.
Yeah, that team
was very
unfortunate, because if you remember, also Perron got hurt
and Manson got hurt.
Yeah, and Perron was just he actually looked good in the playoffs, but the team took a noticeable dip right before the playoffs. Actually, I remember a tweet that I sent. I don't know why I remember this so vividly, but if you looked at the Ducks like rolling Corsi 25 game sample going into the playoffs, literally the date of Perron's injury, you just start seeing a dip in their Corsi. So that was unfortunate. Yeah. It just goes to show how finicky these things can be.
Yeah, definitely. And so, I mean, you look at that team though, how dangerous they were when everyone was healthy. And so the Ducks can kind of get something like that going again. That would be really, really good moving forward. What was it? Paul Ip kind of had a question that kind of goes along with what we were just talking about in terms of the top line. Which one is better on the top line, Kasha or Waugh?
Interesting. We got to be careful here as the founding fathers.
I know.
Of the Kevin Waugh fan club.
I think a lot of it kind of has to depend on who the third guy on that line is. I think if you have Raquel, I think Kasha is much, much better suited for that line. Waugh, we've talked about as being really good in the corners.
But Kasha's better.
Kasha is definitely better. And I think he fits that role better. If you have a guy, if you want to do Kasha and Waugh on that line, that might work decently and put Raquel with Henrique. But I think if you're going with Getzlaf and Raquel, Kasha fits the best there. And I think that, like we said, Waugh would fit perfectly, I think, with Henrique and Perry. I think that would work well.
Yeah, as much as I like Kevin Waugh, I just think Kasha makes more sense in that line, like you just kind of outlined. And, I love Kevin Waugh, but I'd almost rather be putting him on a third line against, say, weaker competition, where he can kind of feast a little bit more. I think that Kasha is a little better suited to withstand kind of the other team's best. I mean, you saw it tonight and the opposition that he faced. One thing that I wanted to note, though, about tonight, which kind of you wouldn't really gauge from what we've said so far, but look, I mean, the Ducks at 5-on-5 tonight were outchanced 25-11, and some of that obviously is score effects, but John Gibson, just another stellar performance. That save that he made on it was Crosby, he just dove across like a soccer goalie and got a piece of it some way somehow. I mean, it goes to back to your article, Jake, about just how much gold. I mean, you put these things together, you know, dominant goaltending and then a superstar like Getzlaf going the other way, and it's difficult for this team to lose. And as they get healthier, I mean, you have to feel a little bit more optimistic now than maybe we did a week ago.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that in the article I'd put that relying on your goaltending like that, like they have so far, is not a recipe for sex or success. Sorry there.
It isn't either. If you lose, well, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to blame the Scotch for that little slip of tongue.
I might have to edit that. We'll see.
No.
We live and die by our mistakes here.
Yep.
Or successes.
So what was I was talking? Oh, yeah, Getzlaf.
Success.
So having that type of goaltending plus having a dominant center like Getzlaf who can push play and hold the puck in the other zone and create chances like he does, that definitely is a recipe for success.
Absolutely. And by the way, if after tonight's win, the Anaheim Ducks are now in the last wild card spot. So they are now in a playoff spot, 1 point ahead of the collective medley of the Calgary Flames, Minnesota Wild, and Chicago Blackhawks. So look, by the way, those three teams all have at least one game in hand on the Ducks. So that's not great. But if you consider the fact of how beat up this team has been, of how much they've struggled in certain aspects of the game, to be in a playoff position right now, and if they win the next game that they play, let's say San Jose loses tonight and the Ducks win their next game, then they're in the third spot in the division. That's impressive, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think the wild card is impressive right now. I think that that's something we can definitely buy into. I think a game or two in hand from other teams isn't the worst thing in the world. I think if we're looking at the divisional race, I think that's a bit harder because San Jose has four games in hand. And
yeah, Vegas, how the hell does that happen? Like, how can the Sharks have four less games played when everyone has roughly the same amount?
Yeah,
if you're Anaheim, though, the hope there would be that will probably equal out at some point. And at some point, maybe the Ducks will actually be on the flip side of this and have a couple games in hand.
Yeah, you definitely hope so. But, I mean, four games is a lot. I mean, that's a big swing that you
can like, have. How does that happen? Come on, NHL schedule makers.
I mean, it's the arenas with all their different things, concerts, Christmas stuff, all that stuff going on right now.
Yeah, so. No, that's a little bizarre. But, yeah, just tonight's game, just to kind of get back to the actual game here, you know, I still maintain that Pittsburgh is maybe not the best litmus test for this team, given how badly they've struggled. But
yes,
it's still a positive indication of where this team is going. I still have some concerns, obviously, moving forward. Another question that we should probably get to here is Georgie Kahn at the GC Ducks fan on Twitter saying, does RC Randy Carlisle start Kessler on limited minutes upon his glorious return to the lineup? Jake, what do you think about that? Does Kessler get limited minutes once he comes back, or does he just get thrown back into the fire? Because he's missed like quite some time.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be thrown back into the fire in terms of playing the same minutes that he was getting previously. I think you're going to see Getzlaf getting the bulk of the minutes for the time being. But I think that it's not like they're going to be playing Kessler fourth line minutes. I think he's going to be playing 17, 18 minutes. I think he'll probably end up back with his old line mates. It's in Cogliano and Silverberg. I just can't see Carlisle really only playing him like 9-10 minutes. To me, Well, yeah, and I think if you're doing that, you're kind of admitting that he's still not 100%. I think you don't put Kessler back in the lineup until he is 100%. And by being 100%, that means that he can play 17 minutes a night.
Yeah, no, I think that with Kessler, it will be interesting, and this kind of leads, I guess, now into a conversation I wanted to have, which is when Kessler returns, we know that we can reasonably assume that he will be back with his, like you said, his usual running mates, Cogliano and Silverberg, but the real question is, you know, what happens to the rest of his lineup, and the questions we've been receiving so far kind of tease at this, because now Kessler's back on the second line. Henrique gets bumped down, presumably. Maybe he gets moved to the wing, although I guess there's a chance of that happening.
But I prefer him at center.
Yeah, I would prefer him as well, just because the alternatives are not so great. So where do you see this forward lineup kind of going? You know, because now, if we want to look at the schedule, Kessler has to be... He can't be very far removed from a return to the lineup. I mean, geez, if I had to pinpoint it, you want to make a bet right now on when Kessler comes back?
Sure, let's go for it.
I'm going to say, let's say Tuesday, January 2nd, against his former team, the Vancouver Canucks.
I'm looking up the schedule right now.
That's my bet.
So
probably not going to happen. But
why don't we do this then? So you're saying Tuesday, December 2nd? So let's put the date as Monday, January 1st. If he's back before that, I win the bet. If he's back after that, you win the bet.
No. Oh, my God. You got to pick a game. You got to pick a game.
Fine. Well, I was going to say the 27th against Vegas, but...
Really? No. You're that optimistic? See, I feel like they're going to give him a little more time.
They've been saying Christmas. I'll go the 29th against Calgary.
Okay. Jeez. Maybe I'm messing up here. I feel like they're going to give him just a touch more time, but I could see him coming back sooner rather than later. I'm just going to go Canucks just for the like arbitrary narrative there, being his former team.
I mean, Calgary does hate him, though.
This is true. I mean, so does kind of everyone in the league, but yeah, those Western Canadian teams are no fans of Ryan Kessler. So let's back here to what I was asking about the lineup. So once Kessler comes back, we know with pretty much absolute certainty what line he's going to be on. That leaves kind of three other lines really up in the air. What's your preferred lineup, or what's kind of your ideal lineup for this team? Which one do you think makes them the most successful?
I mean, it's really hard to say just because I feel like the lines are constantly in flux. I feel like right now I really do like what I'm seeing from the Kasha, Raquel, Getzlaff line. So maybe keep that together for a bit. And then if they stumble, maybe you throw Perry up there. But if you keep that, then you go, we could do Waugh, Henrique, Perry. And I think Henrique and Perry showed really good chemistry during the little stint that they had together. So maybe that could work moving forward. And then worst case scenario, if you really need a goal late in the game, you throw Perry back with Getzlaff and Raquel, and you just put all three of them together and let them go.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that if you look at Anaheim's lineup or how it projects to look, once everyone is healthy, it almost feels like they have two second lines. Like, they don't really have a clear-cut third line. I feel like if you compare – so just to put this out there, my preferred – or what I would think would make them more successful would be, obviously, they're going to go back to that second line. We all know they're going to do that. Like you said, I would keep Kasha, Getzlaff, and Raquel together. Third line, I think we've already said this, I would go Waugh, Henrique, and Perry. But I think that those two lines, you can't really differentiate them. They kind of feel like both like second lines to me.
Yeah.
Which is good news for Anaheim, like, because I feel like I tweeted out about how, like, you know, that would be a good third line between Waugh, Henrique, and Perry, and now, like, Devils fans are getting my mentions saying, oh, look, he's on the third line. It's like, well, no, hold on a second. Like, this is a legit third line. But so then
he's playing with Corey Perry.
Yeah, exactly. But so then what happens to the fourth line? Because now, you know, you got a bunch of guys down there, and, you know, there's only three spots. So what do you think happens there?
I think Vermette is obviously going to end up being the center. It's probably going to be him with some combination of Shaw, Wagner, and Grant, something like that.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna try to make a prediction here. So, Richie definitely stays in the lineup. I think that like there's just zero chance he's ever. I just think
that's probably true. That's probably true. It's probably gonna be Richie there.
So Richie as your left winger, Vermette as your center, and Wagner. It's going to be Vermette and Wagner. Vermette will obviously be the center because of his face-offs. Wagner stays in. I think he's kind of earned it, honestly. I think Derek Grant goes back to San Diego. I think Logan Shaw stays on either as a 13th forward or maybe taking Kevin Waugh's spot in the lineup. I think that there's a chance of that.
I think if anyone takes Kevin Waugh's spot in the lineup, it's going to be Nick Ritchie being moved up.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, in terms of the actual spot, yeah, but in terms of the person coming into the lineup for him, it's going to be probably Shaw. One thing I do want to make a point on is that Shaw, Grant, and Wagner actually haven't been terrible.
Let's hear it then. I'm here for this.
This past week, I have written up my weekly rankings for this week, and I can actually find all the stats if you give me a minute. But at least tonight, Wagner and Grant were both above 50% in Corsi 4 percentage. Shaw was actually below.
Tonight,
below it.
Okay.
Actually, scoring chance 4, they weren't as great. So there went that theory tonight. Damn it.
But neither was really anyone on Anaheim tonight, though, because you look at those scoring chances. So I guess that's kind of a little moot. Yeah.
Let me see, because so for anyone out there, the way I actually combine, I go game by game and combine all the stats for the different games to come up with my weekly rankings. And so on the week, Wagner, Grant, and Shaw for the four games last week were 60. All of them were above 60% in Corsi 4 percentage.
Really?
While over the four games, Wagner got the most time on ice at 5-on-5 at 46 minutes, Grant at 40 minutes, Shaw at 36.
I would have never guessed that.
Yeah, I was very, very shocked. And then expected goal 4 percentage, they were all above 50% also. And so,
interesting.
Yeah, it granted 4-game sample size, but it was really kind of impressive to see that. And so I really liked kind of that line from the past week. And so I don't really see it staying together once everyone's healthy, because I think Vermette kind of slots down, but it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I just don't see Derek Grant stay on this team. Not because, like you said, not because he's been bad or anything, but I just think there's just too many guys pushing him out of the lineup. But I don't know. Maybe we do see maybe the Ducks pull a fast one and just keep him around. I don't know.
Yeah, and we're getting some comments in the Mixler chat. Paulette brought up that we have our 1A and 1B. I would assume he means in Getzlaff and Hrieck, and then we have Kessler, and then we have the checking line. The Honey Badger brings up that Perry and Hrieck seem to have good chemistry together, and I think we both kind of agreed on that and liked them, or liked that line with them together. SJ Hawking thinks Richie Vermette Waugh. Paul It brings up Richie Vermette Wagner. On the Richie Vermette Waugh comment, I think it's been made clear by the coaching staff that if Kevin Waugh's up, he won't be on the fourth line. I've gone on my rant about it. You can go back and probably listen to that episode if you want to hear that. And then Datadog brought up Ducks getting deep. I also like Kessler making some open ice for Sylvie, giving him some extra room for that wicked wrister. So,
I think Kessler's return could also help the penalty kill, because, you know, obviously his face-off ability, that matters a lot more on the penalty kill than it does at even strength. The Ducks not particularly good at the penalty kill last year, even with Kessler in the lineup, but you have to think that he's going to help them in that regard moving forward. I don't know. I feel like, honestly, if I had to put money on it, I would say that the chances of Kevin Waugh being back in San Diego are greater than him staying at this point, because it's like you said, like the coaching staff has said, they don't see him as a bottom six guy, and once everyone's back, I think the coaching staff's mentality will be, well, we have our skill guys now. Like, we're very set in that regard. We need some jam. We need some sandpaper. So I could very well see him being back in San Diego once Kessler comes back.
Yep. Brings a tear to my eyes, as us two being the founding member of the fan club. But
yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. But by the same token, okay, this is like, I'm not even playing devil's advocate here. I'm just saying, if you think about it, Kevin Waugh not being there is, in my mind, not optimal. But this team will, at least I believe, will be so much better regardless, you know, with everyone healthy, at least up front, that maybe it doesn't matter quite as much that he's, you know, on the way out.
But in turn, I'll bring this up, are they better with Kevin Waugh in the lineup?
Yeah, I agree.
As compared to Logan. Like, Kevin, having Kevin Waugh on the third line instead of Nick Ritchie. I think we both agree the answer is yes, and so to me, that makes the answer easy. He should be in the lineup, regardless of they're going to get a bump because of guys coming back.
Yeah, a little rough game for Kevin Waugh tonight, though.
Yeah, as best as we're talking about this.
Yeah, I know, right? 11 minutes played, so kind of not, you know, these are basically fourth line minutes, 27% Corsi. Him, Vermette, and Grant just didn't really seem to work together very well. So, I don't know. Although, thankfully for Kevin Waugh, the coaching staff will not be made aware of any of these numbers. So, that could be the saving grace there. SJ Hawking jumping in the chat here and saying, I'd love to see Cogs, Kessler, and then Wagner/Shaw in three very good offensive lines. I actually wouldn't mind that. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think Kessler, like we've said before, at this point his career could probably use some softer matchups and maybe feast on those a little bit. And then, you know, you kind of go three offensive lines deep. But by the same token, I don't really know who, like, those three offensive lines would be unless you put Ricard Raquel at center.
Yeah, I agree. And I think realistically, as much as we kind of both are kind of don't think Kessler is the best player in the world, he's actually decent and pretty, pretty good offensively. And so it's not as if Cogliano, Kessler, and Silverberg are bad offensively. That line for a long point of last year was the only line that was producing offense for the team. So
yeah,
it's kind of like if you have Cogliano, Kessler, and Silverberg, you do have that third offensive line with them producing. Especially, I actually really do love the idea of Getzlaff matching up against other teams' top line center. I've always liked that idea. And I think that
you saw it tonight.
Yeah, and that gives Kessler some softer minutes and allows him to feast on those minutes. So, yeah.
Totally.
Paul, you good with all that? Because we got another question from Paul.
Yeah. I'm actually kind of like frothing at the mouth for this question.
So all right, I'll read it so you can hit it first. Now that we are almost at a surplus of forwards, do you see any more D-men moves? The D-men combo chemistry is still a big issue.
Look, this is to me maybe my favorite question so far because it really hits at, to me, a pretty big issue for the Ducks right now where, you know, since trading Sammy Vatanen, and this is something I wrote about the day it happened, not to like do a victory lap here, but I guess I'm just going to do one anyway. You look at these numbers for each of their pairings and it's not great. I mean, let's see here if I can get it. God damn it. Let's see if I can get this here. I had my Excel spreadsheet ready to go, and now it's like dying on me.
All right. I can hear it. Oh, you got it?
Yeah. So if you look at these pairings right now, I mean, it's not good. Brandon Montour and Francois Beauchemin have been clearly outshot pretty much throughout the entire course of the season. Cam Fowler with Kevin Bieksa has been equally dismal, 44% Corsi. The only good pairing, and good relative terms, obviously, but the only good possession in the lineup, or the only good possession pairing for the Ducks this season has been Hampus Lindholm and Josh Manson, who have been just destroying the opposition at 54% Corsi. But outside of that, I mean, you have two pairings that are getting clearly outshot. And everyone kind of, it's become this kind of commonly accepted notion, I guess, outside of Anaheim, that the Ducks just have this elite level blue line. And I do, of course, agree that they have a ton of talent. But right now, this combination isn't working. You can't just have only one line that's above, or one pairing that's above break even when the other two are just getting caved in. And obviously, there are some injury effects sprinkled into there. I think that Getzlaff's absence has to be accounted for. But if you kind of dig into Cam Fowler's stats this season, even without Derek Grant on the ice, still getting caved in, right? So, like, Even if you control for the Derek Grant effect, I just think this is a real issue for Anaheim. And to answer the question completely here, we talk about, you know, what are there any more D-men moves coming? Honestly, I don't really see any more coming because I just don't really see them doing that. I feel like they're happy with their pairings, but I think this is a legitimate problem that they're going to kind of be stuck with unless they do something, which I don't see them doing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's as grim as you're saying. I do agree that it's not as good as we all kind of hoped it would be. I definitely do think that it's kind of that one pairing and that's it. I do think there's kind of some easier fixes that I'm not sure if they're exactly going to make. I think if you put Fowler with Montour and just kind of ride that out and you just kind of suck it up and say you're going to have a third pairing that's not going to be that great but play in minimal minutes, that's probably the best way to go about it. I do agree, though. I don't think there's any moves coming. I've actually heard kind of after we've talked a bit that the Ducks are kind of happy with where they're at, just kind of different things that I've heard here and there. And a trade probably isn't likely for anyone. They're kind of happy with the team they have and want to see for a while what they have. So if anything kind of happens, it's most likely going to be probably by deadline time. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I did want to briefly kind of just take a look at Fowler's kind of wowies in terms of what defensemen he's had success with. And Manson, he's been not so good.
Which is not good if you're Anaheim, because that is one – because we've talked a lot about this season about how can you rearrange this blue line so that it works. And Manson and Fowler have not been very good together. They've been – if you look at relative to the team, they've been okay. They're only a minus 0.68 relative Corsi. But if you look at Hampus Lindholm and Josh Manson, 54% crushing it. But then Beauchemin Montour, 46%. Bieksa Fowler, 44%. And like I said just now, Fowler Manson, 46%. So, like, it's really great. Like, I don't know. Like, to me, it's pretty grim outside of that first pairing.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to see. I think with Montour, he was below 40%, but he was at or above 50% in terms of
expected goals, maybe?
Scoring chances.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a little unsurprising to me because Fowler always grades out a little better when it comes to like scoring chances and expected goals. You brought up Lindholm and Montour, and they've only played 13 minutes at 5-on-5 together this season, so it's like an infinitely small sample.
That's probably actually the best way to utilize it.
But they have they had a 62% core seed together, and like, well, I would just be curious to see that more, because I think we've even brought it up. It's like Lindholm is so good at 5-on-5, and then to put a guy like Montour next to him, who's just so excellent offensively, I feel like that could be something interesting.
And I think that then Nutley's, Fowler, and Manson, who haven't been great this year, but we do have a bit more of a history with those two having shown that they can be good together. SJ Hawking brings up, is Fowler good with anyone? Serious question. I know you have some opinions on Fowler. I have some. I'm a really big Fowler fan. I have been for a long time. I think Fowler's kind of been more of a... It's been more of, he's never really had a great partner to play with. I think that's a bit of an indictment of him in terms of...
Well, it's like, at some point, when do we admit that he doesn't make anyone better? You know what I mean?
And
like,
I think that's, you know, fair.
Like, we have a pretty good sample now.
I think that's fair. And I think that from that argument, you can kind of make the point that he's not going to be a number one defenseman on this team.
He is what he is, which is fine.
He's a number two D-man. Lindholm's number one, which for a number two D-man, he's great. But he does rely on having a good partner to be there with him. One thing that's always kind of stuck out to me, and it's something that's kind of been verified by some tracking stats, I believe it's Dmitry Filipovich usually tracks this. Andrew Berkshire does also some really good work. Fowler's amazing at exiting the D zone.
He is, very much so.
He's not that great at defending his own blue line. That's something that's also kind of... These are all kind of numbers that guys will watch games and track as they're going on. He's not that great at defending his own blue line. Lindholm is amazing at that. But if the puck's in his own, Fowler is amazing at getting the puck out and getting out with possession. He very rarely turns it over in his own blue line, which is something that is a good trait to have, and something that even if it does eventually turn over in the offensive zone or doesn't really lead to anything, it's something that is a quality that you want out of your D-man. And so I think it's almost more... That's always kind of led me to believe that it's more a utilization issue, which is why his stats have never been that great.
Yeah, which is interesting, though, because last season he actually did quite well. You know, and he wasn't... I mean, he was playing next to Sami Vatanen, who's not, like, this defensive stalwart by any means, which is... So, you know, to your point about the zone exits, I think that... I mean, you see it every night, even tonight. I mean, Fowler is just so crafty in getting that puck out of the zone with control. One theory, one kind of like pet theory that I've always held is that the reason why he's not good at, I guess like his defensive numbers aren't as good, is because he's really good at exiting the zone. But if you watch what he does with it after, he kind of just skates it to the red line, runs out of ideas, and then dumps it. And typically dump-ins lead to a chance or a shot attempts going the other way. So that's kind of my theory. I would obviously need to verify that. But that's kind of the disappointing thing about Fowler's results this season, is that you would think that next to a guy like Josh Manson, who's so dominant defensively, well, maybe dominant's pushing him, but very good, that he would be better. So anyway, that's just, I guess that's kind of that with the Anaheim blue line. And it's just something that they're going to have to figure out, because I think that it's kind of a glaring weakness in my eyes.
Well, yeah, and I think it's a bit of a work in progress. I feel like the defense, even with everyone healthy, was a bit of a work in progress this year, even with all the pieces.
Even with Vatanen, yeah.
And it was just so much figuring out kind of where everyone should slot. And that can be an issue when you have a lot of really good players. As kind of weird as it sounds, if you have a lot of good players, you got to find minutes for them. You got to find the best way to use them. You can't just throw everyone out there in the most minutes. So that's kind of an issue that they're working through and dealing with, I think, right now.
Absolutely. Okay, so do we have any more questions in the Mixler chat? Because my computer is dead and buried right now, so I have like nothing in front of me. I don't know what's going on in the chat. Anything more there? Because no. I feel like we could probably get to wrapping up here if that's the case.
I don't exactly see anything, and I've now finished my glass of scotch, so...
Well, there you go. We don't want to get into glass two here, because we've already seen what happens with glass one.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So on that note, I'd like to wish everyone a very Merry Christmas.
Yep.
It's a great time of the year. Really enjoy kind of just the holidays. You know, I love being home with family, watching hockey. World Juniors are on. So actually, I guess we should bring that up really quickly. Good Jake. Point.
Yeah. Also, really quickly, if you do, we're going to wrap up soon, but if anyone has a quick question you want us to hit on, throw in the Mixlr chat while I kind of talk about this briefly. World Juniors are going to be coming up. They start on the 26th, I believe. And as of right now, the locks that the Ducks have are Olli Eriksson Ek, I believe, has made the Swedish team. He is the goalie we drafted, I believe, in the second or third round this past year. Bedini got cut. He was in the last, I forgot what round, but he was in the last couple of years also. He was kind of probably going to be a fourth liner on Team USA. Max Jones did make the team. One quick note with Team USA that I did hear the other day with Bob McKenzie talking about it is Team USA is absolutely stacked this year.
Yeah, they are. Casey Mittelstadt.
It's kind of insane. I think that I heard that something along the lines of that Team USA has more first-round picks on their team this year than Team Canada does, and it's the first time that happens in a long time. So the fact that Max Jones is on the fourth line isn't so much where he's at right now. It's more of kind of where Team USA is at. And Team USA is going to take the gold, Felix. I hope you know that. Got a repeat from last year. So moving on to Team Canada, we've got Sam Steele, and he's projected to be the top line center. And actually kind of the shocker out of all of this is I believe Maxime Comtois has made the team.
He did make it, yeah.
And so that
good for him.
That is very, very shocking to me because I did not expect him to be on this team. So that's going to be one fun note to watch. And the third person there that's kind of in limbo a bit is Josh Mahura. He is currently still with Team Canada, even though he was cut. He was brought back due to Dante Fabbro being injured. And kind of his status to the team is all dependent on whether or not Dante Fabbro will be good to go. If Fabbro is good to go, and they have, I believe, up until Christmas to decide because the first game is on the 26th, then Mahura will be sent back. If Fabbro is too hurt to go in that game or to be with the team, then Mahura will make the team and will be playing. So that's kind of where we're all at with World Juniors, and it should be good. And one other thing to note is that I believe it's either the 28th or 29th, Team USA and Team Canada will be playing outdoors at the...
Yes.
Buffalo Bills Stadium in the 10th anniversary of the very first Winter Classic.
Yeah, no, that should be a lot of fun. I was kind of like, I don't know why I always react like this to outdoor games. I was like, that's such a gimmick. But it's going to be a lot of fun, and I feel like those junior guys are going to really get up to that game.
Yeah.
So that should be fun. You want to wrap up here? I think we're done.
Yeah, Datadog just brought up Mahura got 2 assists in the game he played and might entice coaches a bit. I think... They cut him, so I don't think you can cut someone else over him. I think it's basically Fabbro or him at this point.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, we are going to wrap up here. Thank you to everyone for jumping into the Mixlr chat. We got a pretty good turnout tonight, which I guess is unsurprising considering it's the holidays and everyone is home sipping their eggnog or their scotch or their wine or whatever the case may be. Hope everyone has a great holiday. Enjoy this time with your families. I know I do. It's a great time of the year. Watch a lot of hockey and just kind of kick back as we kind of gear up for the second half of the season here. I can't believe we're basically already almost halfway through the season. It's been a fun ride so far. So anyway, Merry Christmas to everyone.
Yep.
That's going to do it for today's show. As always, if you've been enjoying the show, check us out on iTunes. Subscribe there so we can pop up right into your feed. Leave a review or a rating if you really do enjoy the show. That would be very nice, very well appreciated by us. And then, as always, soundcloud.com/ACPod. Search Anaheim Calling the podcast in your SoundCloud app. So you can follow us there and we can pop up right into your feed, no hassle. Give it a heart if you enjoyed the episode on SoundCloud. And as always, AnaheimCalling.com for all your Ducks content needs at Anaheim Calling Twitter. Jake is on Twitter as well at ReindeerGames91, tweeting out his weekly rankings. They're a lot of fun. I am on Twitter at Felix_Sicard, talking about the Ducks constantly, articles, podcasts, whatever you like, Ducks content. I think that'll be of interest to those looking for that. So that's going to do it for us today, guys. We will catch you at the next episode Wednesday night against the Vegas Golden Knights. So don't miss us too much because we know we'll miss you guys.
Bye.